welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, I'll talk to anthology editor Sari Botten about getting a conservative government out of your crotch. North Dakota looks at a ban on abortion at 6 weeks of pregnancy, and the Steubenville rapists are found guilty in juvenile court. After enduring a shocking rampage of online abuse months ago when she started to raise money for a video series on sexism in video games, Anita Sarkeesian of Feminist Frequency has now started to release the videos. The first is on the prevalence of the damsel in distress storyline in video games. She starts off with what sounds like an address to her critics who tried to silence her before she even had a chance to express her opinion.
This project will examine the tropes, plot devices, and patterns most commonly associated with women in gaming from a systemic, big-picture perspective. This series will include critical analysis of many beloved games and characters, but remember that it's both possible, and even necessary, to simultaneously enjoy media while also being critical of its more problematic or pernicious aspects.
You can love something while being adult enough to be critical of its politics. Of course, I suspect many of Anita's critics are perfectly happy with the reactionary and even misogynist politics in many video games, and that's why they got so angry. Until now, state restrictions on when you can get an abortion are rationalized politically as not being abortion bans because they supposedly give women sufficient time to get an abortion. Anti-choicers are counting on misogynist stereotypes about women being fickle and stupid to imply that bans on abortion after 20 weeks, or now, in Arkansas, 12 weeks, are okay because they'll supposedly only affect women who were too lazy to do it earlier or something. In reality, most women who wait until 12 weeks or even 20 weeks have a good reason to do so, often because of health problems or access problems. But anti-choicers pretend otherwise. But now the charade about giving women enough time to decide has ended in North Dakota, where the legislature passed an abortion ban at 6 weeks.
But now we know that the Arkansas decision is not an outlier. Arkansas does not stand alone, because now Republicans in North Dakota have passed an even more extreme and obviously unconstitutional ban on abortion. Theirs doesn't start at 12 weeks, theirs starts at 6 weeks, which is before many women even know they're pregnant in the first place. North Dakota's Republican governor has 3 days to either sign or veto the bill. He has not said what he will do, but the bill passed with enough votes in the House and the Senate that even if he does veto it, the legislature can just override him like they did in Arkansas.
At this point, I don't see why not just ban abortion after a woman finds out she's pregnant. You can abort right up until you take that pregnancy test, but once you know for sure, no more abortions for you. As a bonus, such a ban allows the police to ransack women's homes and garbage cans looking for pregnancy tests. We can leave it up to individual states whether or not women will have to have a transvaginal probe during the search process. The beauty of this is it creates a perfect loop where no single abortion can get through, but you can still pretend that you haven't banned abortion. Win-win. So why is the ban so early? What's the rationale? As usually, it's the heartbeat nonsense.
The purpose of House Bill 1456 is quite simple. Prohibiting an abortion if the unborn child the pregnant woman is carrying has a detectable heartbeat. An exception is provided to protect the life or health of the mother. We all know the significance of a heartbeat. It is the universally accepted biological proof of life. We may have witnessed the loss of a loved one being cared for in a hospital, one moment hearing the presence of the heartbeat via the heart monitoring machine, the next moment experiencing the deafening silence of a heart beating no more. The heartbeat offers an undeniable truth about life.
What's interesting is that this is a blatant lie, since anti-choicers claim to believe that life begins at fertilization and not at the heartbeat. It's not indisputable, since they themselves dispute it. Nor is there any biological reason to claim that life begins with a heartbeat, since many creatures and plants and one-celled animals don't have hearts and yet are still alive. Of course, all these people eat plants and animals, so life is not actually what they're protecting. By and large, we all accept that if a person's brain dies, they are dead, even if you can artificially pump their heart into infinity. Additionally, a pair of Siamese twins that share a heart but have two separate heads would get two names. It's clear that we think of people as being their brains, not their hearts. Anti-choicers are only trying to change the rules because embryos have hearts but don't really have brains in the same way we do. Not that any of this matters, because you also know who has a heart and a brain? The pregnant woman. But because she's had sex, I guess she forsakes the basic right to control her body. The appalling dishonesty on display from supporters of the heartbeat bill came out during the debate.
The court has been very clear that a state has an important and legitimate interest in protecting the potentiality of human life from the very outset of pregnancy. The court stated, and I quote, "Logically, of course, a legitimate state interest in this area need not stand or fall on the acceptance or belief that life begins at conception or at some point prior to life. In assessing the state's interest, recognition may be given to the less rigid claim that as long as potential life is involved, the state may assert interests beyond the protection of the pregnant woman alone."
He neglects to mention that the court then went on to argue that a woman's interest in bodily autonomy outweighed state interest in the fetus before viability. Overlooking this can't be chalked up to ignorance. Anti-choicers know what Roe versus Wade is, believe me. This line of argument suggests the legislature knows that their bill will be overturned by the courts, but they are willing to use taxpayer funds to mount a pointless court battle anyway, in the slim hope that it will go to the Supreme Court and Roe will be overturned. In a sense, however, this is all symbolic politics, despite the money that will be spent. The larger threat comes from the bill requiring admitting privileges to the local hospital, one that will be passed with the full knowledge that North Dakota's clinic doesn't need and won't therefore be able to get those privileges. I'd like to welcome Sari Botten to the program. Sari is a freelance journalist and a writer who has published with The Rumpus, The New York Times, New York Magazine, and The Village Voice, amongst others. She's one of the editors of a new book called Get Out of My Crotch, 21 Writers Respond to America's War on Women's Rights and Reproductive Health. It came out in January, and she's here to talk about it. Welcome to RealityCast, Sari.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, easy question right off the top. Why did you decide to put together this collection?
I first of all had gone, I run a storytelling workshop, and we held a women's retreat one weekend, and there were women who ranged in age from 19 to 78, and somehow one of them brought up, one of the older women brought up the topic of her illegal abortion before Roe v. Wade. And then that prompted three other women to start talking about theirs. And none of them had ever spoken to anyone about their abortions. And then after the women who had had illegal abortions revealed theirs, all the other women who had had legal ones started talking about them for the first time. And I admitted for the first time that I had too. I had never told anyone in my life, except like my gynecologist. And I thought, this is messed up, you know, that none of us will admit to having had abortions. And there was a 19-year-old woman in the room who said that she had never met anyone who had an abortion before, and she used to have a dim view of women who did, and she was really glad to meet women who had had them. And I thought, this is exactly who needs to hear people talking about abortion, young voters, young women voters, you know, who don't know what it was like to not have abortion as an, you know, to have choice, not to have choice. So that for me was the beginning. And then someone put me in touch with Kim Wyatt, my co-editor. And, you know, both of us had been enraged. You know, what a year this was with Todd Akin talking about, you know, that you can't get pregnant from rape. So many states wanting women to have transvaginal sonograms before they can have their abortion so that they can actually feel bad about seeing the baby. You know, I think it was Arizona wanted to make conception begin at ovulation. Mitt Romney was, you know, he vowed to overturn Roe v. Wade. There was so much in the run-up to the 2012 election, so much rhetoric about, you know, turning back the clock on women's reproductive rights and you know, women's health, that the two of us were just enraged and we felt like we had to do something about it. And that's why we put together the collection. That's my landline.
Oh, no worries. So you put together the selection?
Yeah, we put together the collection because we were responding to all the rhetoric, just about how the Republicans and conservatives wanted to turn back the clock on women's reproductive rights.
So I think a lot of us fear that this new influx of restrictions on abortion and contraception that are coming down the pipe are the harbinger of a general return to a pre-feminist era, that this was like that feminism came and now it's going away. But your marketing materials kind of cast it a little differently. They say it's more like the patriarchy's last gasp. Why do you see it that way?
I think both things are happening. But I think that the feminists, the people who, our book really preaches to the choir. I mean, conservative woman is going to pick up a book called Get Out of My Crotch. With the Statue of Liberty in gynecologist stirrups on the cover. But we feel like the choir is galvanized they're fighting the fight. And so, but I also think, the other is happening. There are a lot of young women who aren't aware of what it was like before and don't think they have anything to lose. So, and also I think that feminism still has a bad name and maybe we need some new terminology, because people associate feminism with angry, anger and no fun and humorless. And I think that to a lot of young women, it doesn't appeal. So I think both are happening.
So your piece in the book is called Confessions of a Good Girl. So can you kind of tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, that piece was born out of that women's retreat I was just telling you about, where I admitted for the first time to a room full of women that I had had two abortions. And there was a 19-year-old girl in the room who had previously had a dim view of women who had had abortions. And I realized, okay, I need to get over myself and stop being concerned. And the idea that I think that people are judging me because I had an abortion or two, I'm reinforcing whatever it is that's making me feel judged by keeping quiet. And I don't want to perpetuate the stigma. And I think that we need to get people talking about abortion. In the story, I talk about telling my mom about chemical abortion, which I had had the second time, so that she could tell her son's daughter, who was new, she was pregnant like by 8 weeks, and you can still have chemical abortion up to, I guess, 10 weeks. And I wanted to be able to be helpful instead of protecting my image as a good girl and being afraid of being judged. I wanted to, you can be helpful to people if you can share stuff. By the way, today in the New York Times, front page of the New York Times is that in Arkansas, they're putting the most restrictive terms in that you can't do it beyond 12 weeks. There's so much still happening. It doesn't even matter that Mitt Romney didn't get into office, that it's not a GOP presidential administration. This stuff is still happening, and so we have to keep alert.
So why do you think, what sort of stereotypes or stigma about abortion do you think could be reversed by talking more openly about people's experiences with it?
I think the idea that I think there's a lot of slut shaming, I think at least on the part of the conservatives, there's this idea that if a woman had sex and a pregnancy that she didn't want, that she shouldn't have been having extramarital sex. Or premarital sex without protection or whatever. There are a lot of instances in which people get pregnant when they're in a marriage and they don't want to be pregnant, or they're in a marriage that's abusive and they don't want to bring a child into it, or you know, there are so many reasons that women have abortions. And also, you're not a slut if you have an abortion outside of marriage. You know, you get pregnant outside of marriage. And also just the choice to not have a child if you aren't able. Look, I know that I don't have the tools to be a parent for assorted reasons. I don't have the tools. And so I would be doing more of a disservice, I think, if I were to become a parent than to, you know, I would be doing a disservice to that child. And I think there are a lot of women who are in situations where it doesn't, it would be better. And I don't think that they should be ashamed of that.
So where do you see reproductive and sexual rights fitting into the larger tapestry of women's fight for equality?
I think it's so vital. I think Barack Obama said in one of the presidential debates that, you know, women's ability to have access to birth control and abortion makes it so that they can, you know, be more active in the workforce. I mean, if women were having 13 children the way they were before, you know, there was access to birth control, we wouldn't be able to be in the workforce. You know, it's vital to just how, I think it's one of the most important issues. And it's women's health. It's like, you know, we need to be able to get the health care that we need. Some of us need birth control pills for endometriosis. I had a very bad endometriosis, and before a hysterectomy, I was often on the pill for, sometimes I was on double doses of the pill. You know, there's people who wanted to make legislation that would make it so that women with endometriosis couldn't get their birth control covered by insurance. And I think that was part of what happened with Sandra Fluke. I think that maybe one of the reasons that she had it, I can't remember exactly, but you know, they don't, it's women's health. I mean, that is so vital. I think it's so important to the women's movement and, you know, women advancing as equals in this country.
My guest today has been Sari Botten, and the book is called Get Out of My Crotch, 21 Writers Respond to America's War on Women's Rights and Reproductive Health. It's a place where you can kind of get a more personal response than the sort of daily grind of the blogs covering these issues. You can find it online and at your local bookstore. Thanks so much for coming on to RealityCast, Sari.
Thank you for having me, Amanda.
After months of contentious coverage and debate online, Trent Mayes and Malik Richman of Steubenville, Ohio, have been convicted of rape in juvenile court.
It's not surprising, this verdict. The state of Ohio's law is very clear on this. If a victim does not show any physical resistance, it doesn't mean anything. It's irrelevant.
Right. So the point here is essentially that Mays was accused of having sexual contact with the victim, and what had to be proved, and so did and Malik as well, what had to be proved under Ohio law was that she was incapable of giving consent because she was incapacitated. That's really all that had to be proven. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Since both young men were tried as juveniles, they received relatively light sentences, with Richmond getting 1 year and Mays getting 2. However, they are juveniles, which means those are minimum sentences and they can be held until they're 21 if the state determines they aren't fit to be released. Their names will be added to a sex offender registry at that point if the judge determines. What was remarkable about this case is that there was such an overwhelming crush of evidence against the defendants. Not only were there videos, pictures, and eyewitness testimony, but Mays sent out a flurry of text messages to his friends and the victim that resulted in a tacit admission of guilt. Because of this, the verdict isn't really a surprise, especially since it was only a judge making the determination, which made it harder for the defense to distract him from applying the law fairly by making a fuss over how unpopular the victim is. The defendants and their friends left a massive trail of evidence of the rape on social media for fairly obvious reasons, which is that they were proud and excited about this, because they live in a sexist culture that teaches that abusing women makes you edgy and cool. There have been young men raping women and then bragging about it to their friends long before cell phones and Twitter. So it's not a surprise that they'd use these new technologies for the same old purposes. Unfortunately, some of the responses have made it sound like the technologies are to blame, as if the young rapists never thought to brag about their crimes before they could do so on Twitter.
It is a high-profile case that has turned the small, close-knit town of Steubenville, Ohio, upside down.
Shame on you!
And serves as a cautionary tale for teenagers living in today's digital world.
Cautionary tale? That makes it sound like the problem wasn't the rape itself, but recording it in such a way that it makes it easy to prove that you did it. Calling this a cautionary tale implies that the lesson to be taken from this is that if you rape, you should do a better job of covering your tracks. Sadly, even the judge implied as much, scolding the defendants for using social media. In reality, we should be glad they recorded their actions and talked about their crimes online and in text. Because of that, we have proof they did it and can hold them accountable. In that sense, social media and transparency it creates is a good thing. Unfortunately, the inability of so many people to understand that rape is a violent crime was put on full display in the media reaction to this verdict. CNN, for some reason, decided to cover the young rapist with a tragic hero narrative. Poppy Harlow said this.
I've never experienced anything like it, Candy. It was incredibly emotional, incredibly difficult, even for an outsider like me, to watch what happened as these two young men that had such promising futures, star football players, very good students, literally watched as they believed their life fell apart. One of the young men, Malik Richmond, when that sentence came down, he collapsed. He collapsed in the arms of his attorney, Walter Madison. He said to him, "My life is over. No one is going to want me now."
Not a word about how hard and emotionally devastating it has been for the victim, even though she too broke down in court when pictures that were taken to humiliate her were shown to her on the witness stand. Nor was a word given to the fact that she endures harassment all the time from local residents who are mad their star football players can't play anymore. The coverage continued like this, with Candy Crowling asking legal expert Paul Callan about the verdict.
The thing is, when you listen to it and you realize that they could stay until they're 21, they are going to get credit for time served. What's the lasting effect, though, on two young men being found guilty in juvenile court of rape, essentially?
Well, you know, Candy, we've seen here a courtroom drenched in tears and tragedy. And, you know, Poppy's description, I think, sums it all up. But across America, scenes like this happen all the time. I know as a prosecutor and a defense attorney, when that verdict is handed down, usually it's just the families of the defendants and the victims. There's always that moment of just lives are destroyed and lives have already been destroyed by the crime. And we got a chance to see that.
Look, I know that it's important to cover how emotional this is for young men and their families, but the passive language here is absolutely infuriating. Lives aren't being randomly destroyed. These young men actively tried to destroy a young woman and paid the price for it. They did this to themselves. I struggle to imagine any other crime that would be covered as if the criminal just stumbled into making the active choice to hurt and humiliate someone like this. We need to start talking about rape as a choice rapists make, and not as something that just happens to them. Until rapists are held morally accountable for rape, rape will continue. And now for the wisdom of wingnuts. They will never stop obsessing over Sandra Fluck edition. Sandra Fluck suggested birth control is a good thing, and conservatives will never forgive her for it. Ann Coulter took a swipe at Fluck during CPAC, of course.
I think that haircut is birth control enough.
Ironically, Ann Coulter spent much of her speech complaining about Republicans saying stupid stuff, and then she went ahead and continued to abuse a woman for supporting contraception access, which 99% of women use. If you want to have people stop thinking you're radical misogynist, perhaps start by not attacking the healthcare needs of 99% of women.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.